Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning. I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News, now in depth on what it means to be an American.
The essence of America, what really unites us, it is an idea that you can come from humble circumstances and you can do great things.
This nation was founded by men of many nations and backgrounds. It was founded on the principle that all men are created equal.
We are the free and unconquerable people of the United States of America.
I'll tell you what freedom is to me. No fear.
The story of America is one of people who have made their dreams come true by realizing that the time for action is always now.
I hope you've caught parts of the series Roseanne Cash reflecting on how geography and family roots influence what it means to her to be an American. Jossie Ross thinking about how his father and his grandfather's wartime sacrifices inform his view. Julissa Arce viewing Americanism from the outside in. Today, it's your turn. As our guest joins us, I'd like to hear who we the people are in your view, and how that informs your idea of what it means to be an American. The obligations, the responsibility, the sense of collectivism, who we are today. Keep it concise, if you will. I want to hear from as many people as we possibly can, but I want to hear your perspective on what it means to be an American today. 651-227-6000. 800-242-2828, Steph Curtis at nprnews.org/live, and I'm on Twitter at Carrie NPR. Jose Santos is the brave man who has decided to come in and and do this with me. He's an anthropologist and professor of Metro State University, and welcome. It's good to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me.
And again, I really appreciate that you've listened to some of the series.
So. I have. It's pretty gripping, and I think for a lot of us, it breaks your heart, actually.
You said that when you sat down. Tell me why.
It hurts. For me, the issue of trying to figure out what does it mean to be American is a painful one. So my parents are immigrants, and that's something that, on the one hand, really emphasizes certain aspects of what's great about America, but on the other hand, really emphasizes the things that hurt, the things that are difficult, the parts where you get kicked around and told that they don't want you here. And so there's this kind of inner conflict for a lot of us when we hear that.
Julissa Arce, I think, spoke to that really well. I don't know if you heard that
episode.
Okay. So to remind our listeners, she is the young woman whose visa to be in the United States, her parents were from Mexico, brought her in. That visa expired at the age of 14. And she began exactly what you, this experience of, I know that a lot of people do not want us here, and yet I want to be so connected to this country.
Right. And feeling you've got to prove it, right?
Right.
Feeling that's something that's, you're going to get this extra scrutiny and you're going to scrutinize yourself a little more than other people. And that when you do succeed and you do well, there's this sadness that thinking that the most that you can hope for in other people's eyes is, oh, you're one of the good ones. Right. We're going to put a door in the wall for you, right, to let you in because you're one of the good ones. And that's painful.
How do you think your perception of what it means to be an American, that ideal, differs from your parents? It's because your parents,
very greatly.
Here.
I think for me, I think, you know, the greatness, I think, is so much clearer for the immigrant. And in some ways, so much more obscured for the immigrant's child. And that's because the immigrant can come here and do the things they want to do. And this kind of painful stuff is background noise to them. And it's expected, right? It's like when you come someplace new, you know it's going to be hard. You know people are going to make fun of your accent. You know, you just expect that, I think, in some ways. And you expect it to be difficult. Except when you're born in this country, this whole notion of the American dream is kind of, you know, you learn it in school. You hear it around yourself, and it's for everybody and all this, and it sets up this fantasy that is confusing, and it's very sobering to confront, like, the hard side of it. You know, when you say, you know, the dream, right, I, I've really been thinking about how that dream, you know, one person's dream is another one's nightmare. I had an experience earlier this year. I had a breakup over the summer, but the woman that I'd been seeing, I'd met her father, and he was sort of the pinnacle of the American dream. He grew up a very poor rural background, and then he becomes an engineer, and he moves to St. Paul, and he starts working for the city, becomes very influential working for the city. He has a great career, raises, you know, four great kids. They go off and do great things, and then now is you know, bought a farm and is retired there. Right. You know, what's more American dream than that?
Yeah.
And he knew about my background. You know, both my parents are immigrants. And then one day we're sitting down and he was when Trump first started getting started, and he was really fascinated with Trump. And he thought, you know, he was supporting him at the time. I don't know if he does now. And he asked me, he's like, you know, Jose, I know you're a smart guy. I know, you know, you read a lot. You know, I was a professor, and that was kind of, you know, something set aside, I guess. He was trying to be respectful. And he's like, I know you know things like this. Why is it we don't just make it so that the children of immigrants aren't citizens here? Right. And this is knowing full well, well, that means me. You'd take your citizenship from me and my sister and, you know, millions of other people.
Wait a minute. I thought he was asking you, why don't we make it so that.
No, he was saying,
why don't we take it away?
Yeah. So that when immigrants come here and have children, that their children are not by default.
See. Okay. So he's asking, why do we confer citizenship?
Yeah, why do we confer citizenship to the children of immigrants? And so I answer the question kind of academically, right? Like I field it, right? And I'm sort of, well, so there's just the issue of the Constitution, right? And the way it's written, and you know, you need to change that because that's in there, and it would require, you know, such and such number of state legislatures or, you know, the supermajority of Congress and so on. And he's like, oh, okay, so it's because it's too difficult. And I'm like, yeah, and people like myself we'd fight you. And so here's this guy who's in some ways the epitome of the American dream, and his dream, his pursuit of it, the way he sees it, that he wants it to play out, would take away my dream. It would take away my parents' dream. It would make it so that my dream can't come true. And I think that's kind of an American legacy. You know, I think slavery is a really good example of that. Here's this, you know, huge amount of agricultural land that we want worked. And my dream is to turn this into this big, huge plantation and this wonderful thing that's so productive and feeds the country and all this. And I need slaves to do that. And so you take away their lives and you take away their dreams and their children's dreams so that your dream can be fulfilled.
This is why you said one man's dream is another man's nightmare.
Exactly.
I want to play a little bit from Julissa, who, again, for listeners who didn't catch that episode, she's her parents bring her into the country. She has a visa until she's 14. It expires. And then she begins this experience of excelling in school and high school and college and being recruited to Wall Street, all the while knowing that if anybody knew that she was undocumented, they would view her completely differently. And what it meant to feel that connection, even knowing that she was guarding this secret, kind of from the outside in. Let's listen.
I had this idea that if I could just become really financially and professionally successful, that it wouldn't matter that I was undocumented, that I could prove to people who didn't think I should be here that in fact I did belong here because I earned my way, right? Like I worked so hard and look how much I've achieved, and maybe that would make me like worthy of being an American. You know, that's where my sort of dream of going to go work on Wall Street began.
I mean, Jose, this is what you said about we want the right ones to be here.
Right. And she felt, you know, I don't want to speak for her, but if I extrapolate from what she's saying, is she wanted to be one of the right ones. She wanted to be worthy. Right. I mean, that was the word that she used, worthy of the dream. And who doesn't, right? And I've known that feeling many times in my life, and it's a driving force. I think who was it that you had on that was talking about how part of the dream is that it creates ambition. It's a constant searching for the dream that is the dream.
I think that's Luis Urrea.
Yeah, that if you actually achieve it, then you've got nothing left to do, right?
Right.
So it's got to be constantly out of reach. And so I think there's this inherent feeling of I'm not doing good enough, somewhere implicit in the American dream, that I have to do more, right? I have to do more. But on the other hand, like her feeling, right, that as an immigrant, that if I do it, maybe then I can be one of them, or
if
they'll
do
just
it the
let
way
me stay.
It looks
right,
right,
yeah,
right. Then yeah. They'll forgive what they don't even know.
Yeah.
Let me grab a call here from Nicole in La Crescent. Hi, Nicole. How are you thinking about this question?
Well, I just think that, you know, I'm not an immigrant. I'm not a child of an immigrant. You know, I grew up in the Midwest, and I just feel like, to me, being an American is I have the freedom to live my life the way that I think is best and to raise my children the way that I think is best and practice whatever religion I feel like practicing. And in turn, it's my duty to respect everyone else's freedom to do the same thing. And I don't have to agree with it. And, you know, but it's their right, you know, and my duty as a citizen is to vote and pay my taxes and obey the law. And, you know, and I'm optimistic enough to think that if there is something that I deep in my core don't agree with, that I do have a voice in changing that, and I should. So,
Nicole, I really appreciate, I'm glad we took you first too, because we haven't talked that much about the duty and the obligations and the responsibility of being an American citizen. I was on another kind of philosophical exploration with some of our guests, Jose, but it's a good thing to take up. America gives you things, you give America things,
what do we,
right?
What do we owe?
Have we forgotten that?
What do we owe? You know, we think back to Kennedy, right? Ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. I think we forget it. I think we forget what is owed. I think one of the things that I really liked what the caller just said is, okay, yeah, I feel that it means I have a right to live my life the way I want to live, which is pretty standard. And then she added something, and that means respecting the way that other people want to do things and their freedom to do things the way they want to do it. And I wonder if it occurs to people that isn't just a nice thing, but that's an obligation, that's our duty, is that, okay, there's going to be this other person that is so different from me and wants to do things different from me. And that something about America is that they get to do that, and I get to do what I'm doing over here. And yet at the same time, we can be pretty intolerant. I was actually looking at stuff that John Steinbeck had written about the American dream. He calls it paradox and dream.
Uh-huh.
At the same time. And he says part of what's great about being American is we get so excited and we feel so passionate about the things we believe in, right? And yet we feel it to the point where we feel like, well, everybody should believe this, right? He's like, it doesn't matter if it's a political belief or being a vegetarian. He said, if I become a vegetarian, it becomes the most important thing, and I think other people should be a vegetarian. That's the American way, right?
I haven't thought about it that way, but yeah.
And yet our obligation, right, in order for this thing to work, if we want it to work for everybody, which we're at least saying, right, which we're at least saying that we want, means that part of our obligation is like, it's okay for them to do what they want to do. It's okay for that guy at the next table to be eating that bologna sandwich. So, yeah, I'm glad we started with her, too.
I think one of the other obligations is something that comes up in this poem that I started all of those conversations with. And that's the Langston Hughes poem, Let America Be America Again. And I asked everybody about this phrase, let America be the dream the dreamers dreamed. And what you just said reminds me that your image and your dream of what America is may not align with the person next to you, but it's having the room to acknowledge and respect that dream.
Yeah. How great would that be?
Right.
But I think in many ways, like what we're living right now, or at least what we're seeing in the media and a lot of us are feeling, is that there's no space for that. There's a lot of all or nothing kind of talk, right? Like, you know, so the notion of make America great again, it's got a very specific plan for what kind of America it wants, right?
Right.
It's hearkening back to this kind of nostalgic thing. It's like a revitalization movement. And then for a lot of us, that vision is scary. It's a scary one. But what's coming out of there is like, well, this is what needs to be. This is how it should be, right? And the people that are against it, well, they're wrong, right? They need to be vegetarians too, right? Like they need to make it great again too.
But remember in that poem, there is also that, I mean, I think the poem is saying, we never were the dream. And then there is this voice that keeps coming into the poem to say, but America never was that for me. You know, it's that second voice.
It's that ability to criticize, right?
That
so many of your guests have talked about.
Exactly.
That if we lose that, then it's, I guess it's the difference between, I think it's worth thinking about, you know, is the American dream actually a plan or is it really just a fantasy?
Yeah.
Because if it's just a fantasy, you never have to fix it. You never have to mess with it. You never have to do anything with it. It's just sort of, I'm living this dream. Oh, it's so wonderful. You never have to stop and think, wait a minute, am I asleep and dreaming or did I make this real? And so if it's just a dream, you can live in that delusion. If it's just a, you know, literal dream. But if it's the American dream, the way we've been talking about it, you know, you have to wake up and do something. And that means scrutiny. And that means thinking about, you know, the caller's name was Nicole. Is that mm-hmm. correct? Like Nicole said, well, if I see something that's wrong, I not only do I have the right to speak up, I have the duty to do so. What a great America that would be, right?
Jose Santos is with us. He's an anthropologist and professor at Metro State University. And I asked him to come sit in as, for the first time in the series, we opened the phone lines, we opened the social media channels, and we asked you to reflect on this idea of what it means to be an American. You've heard Claudia Rankine and Luis Urrea and Roseanne Cash and others reflect on this. Now, Jose and I are here to take your calls and think about what you're suggesting and asking you to do a little soul searching. As I said at the beginning of the hour, it's not about patriotism. It's about all the conflicts and the contradictions of who we are as Americans and what we want and what we the people really is. And I love this question that Jesus asked Jose. Is it a fantasy or is it hard and real? Right. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, on Twitter at @CarrieNPR, where Patrick says, being an American is summed up in E pluribus unum, out of many, one. We fall short often, but should always aspire to this. And to Howie in White Earth. Hey, Howie, thanks so much for waiting. How are you thinking about this?
Well, I was thinking about Native Americans who were the first people who had a culture here already. And Vine Deloria Jr., the great Lakota scholar, wrote a book in which he talked about how Americans today tend to talk about rights. I have rights, all kinds of rights. He said, what about responsibilities? That the body politic, that the community needs to have a deep sense of the common good. And sometimes individual rights need to be put aside so that everybody is served. And I just thought that thinking that Deloria did on that topic is so on target with what we face today. Not just rights, but responsibilities.
I'm really glad you've picked up on that.
Absolutely.
Jose?
Can I ask you one thing?
Sure.
Yeah. If there is a responsibility that you want people to remember, a responsibility that you just wish so that you could feel good about the fact that you said it right out loud and you want them to take it home, what is that? What is one responsibility that you wish as Americans we would take better care of?
I think it's care for those who cannot help themselves, the elderly, small children, the disabled.
I'm kind of with you on that one. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
I want us to listen to Jazzy Ross. He's a young activist based out in the Pacific Northwest, Native American, hip hop. He brings a lot of different dimension to this question. And one of the things that we talked about with Jazzy was the idea of how powerful optimism is to the center of this idea of the American dream, for good and for ill. But here's Jazzy on that.
I see all of these things that people call political correctness, people call, being overly sensitive. It's beautiful. Thank God we're being sensitive. We have literally hundreds of years of insensitivity. We have a lot of sensitivity to make up for. And so I'm incredibly optimistic because I see a heightened sense of humanity amongst our children.
What do you hear in that, Jose? I thought that was an interesting perspective.
What I hear in that is, on the one hand, yeah, it's time to be overly sensitive. The things that we used to let go, maybe we don't have to let them go, right? And on the other hand, I start thinking in terms of duties that maybe one of our duties as Americans is to make each other uncomfortable, right?
Yeah.
You know, the political correctness, it can be really annoying for a lot of people, just really annoying. Just keeping up with, well, how am I supposed to even say, you know, how do I refer to African-Americans, or how do I refer to Black people, or how do I refer to Latinos, or is this okay to say or not? And I think a lot of times people put the stranglehold on their tongues.
But if that's your biggest concern...
Right, really? That's something that you can get over. But also that you know, part of it is for America to move forward, there's got to be that level of uncomfortableness where people are annoying each other until they realize, oh my God, I'm slightly annoyed, but it's because there's this much, much bigger thing that the person that's annoying me is talking about. I think ultimately, one of the things I'm really concerned about with the election is that after the election, right, let's assume the polls are correct, and Hillary Clinton wins, is that we're going to forget that there's a whole lot of Americans that were screaming, make America great again.
Mm-hmm.
And that was annoying, right? That's annoying a lot of people. It's annoying a lot of people in the left, and it's offending a lot of people. But we need to listen to what they're saying, because we're sharing this country. And if that doesn't get addressed, something bad is going to happen. It's not going to go away.
I think the challenge is to turn a slogan that I don't think Donald Trump ever really added a lot of depth to, but to understand what it was that voters are responding to about mm-hmm. that, and then to turn that into, you know, put some flesh on the bones of that. I mean, what does that really mean?
I'd love to hear from a caller on that. What does that mean when you use the phrase "Let's make America great again"?
Right.
What is this again, right? What's this past that we're referring to? What are the things that we're missing?
It's a good question here because, I mean, it is in the context of what it means to be an American. And is your perception of what it means to be an American something that is steeped in nostalgia? I mean, does it harken back to a different time? Is that how and why you respond to this idea that Donald Trump has been talking about? 651-227-6000. 800-242-2828 to the phones to Rick in St. Paul. Hi, Rick.
Hi, how are you?
Doing good. Thanks for waiting. What are you thinking about?
Well, I just hope that our society doesn't turn into one of the situations where it's, I got mine, screw the rest of you. Because if that happens, this country won't stand for freedom anymore. I mean, granted, people should take advantage of the opportunities that are handed to them free, education, whatever things they can get to improve themselves, but they have an obligation to follow their dream and go farther. I've preached to my children that all the things that come in life that are free are great, but the things that you appreciate the most in life are the things that you've had to work the hardest for.
Rick, I actually think you've put your finger on the inequality gap here. And this is actually something that I talked to Eddie Glaude about yesterday, the theologian from Princeton, this idea that are we turning into a nation that says, well, we can't really solve that inequality, and a lot of us have a lot, and so that's kind of going to be who we are.
Right, And then the concern that was just brought up about, well, then what are we teaching the kids?
Right.
What are we? What is the value that we're imparting there? Because so much of dreaming, so much of dreaming in general is about greed. You're only dreaming about the things you want, right? The things that you want to achieve and the things you want to have. And so there's this kind of inherent kind of gimme.
It's kind of a materialism.
Yeah, in it.
To that, right.
But how do we balance that so that we don't turn the next generations into ones that just take and take and take? And I think a lot of people feel like he was feeling, that we're seeing a lot of that. I think one of the things I really wish had been addressed in one of the presidential debates,
mm-hmm.
it was the first question, I think, in the second debate, and it was a woman asking, well, you know, what are we supposed to tell our kids about this? What are we supposed to tell?
I noticed the candidates didn't really answer that.
They dodged it, right? And I wish that had been addressed more clearly, because I think when things are just had turned into a circus like they have been, I think that's when it's time for an adult to step in the room. And if an adult's not going to be one of the people that's at one of these two podiums, then it's got to be mom and dad at home. And they got to say, okay, son, daughter, whatever, let's watch this. But let me give you some understanding as to what's going on here and how to make sense of it. right? I want you to be able to draw conclusions from this. I don't want you to take the easy way out and say, oh, we like the red guy or we like the blue guy, right? I want you to have to figure this out and realizing that it's going to be too confusing for you, right? It's not going to make sense at first, but we need, I'm here to nurture this along. I think it is a good question. When our politics has just gotten so nasty that people don't want their kids in the room, we got to figure out, well, then who's the adult here? It's got to be us, the citizens, and it's not our politicians.
Here's a Princeton theologian and author of Democracy in Black, Eddie Glaude Jr. If you missed the whole conversation that I had yesterday with him, I have to say it's one of my favorites of the whole series. Catch it on the podcast. But here's a bit of where he thinks about some difficult days ahead of us.
James Baldwin is fond of saying that America is like a monotonous minstrel show. The same old songs, the same old jokes, the same old dances. We've done the song, you know, we've done the dances so long we could do it in our sleep. And you combine that, the kind of the theater of race that has defined this country since its beginning, with this kind of stark economic reality, then, you know, we are on the horizon of deep, deep chaos. As to paraphrase Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., we have some really difficult days ahead.
What he said at the beginning of that about this minstrel show idea really struck you, didn't it?
Long, monotonous minstrel show. This things of, okay, everybody get ready for this performance, that so much of American life is, well, here's what you're supposed to do and make sure it looks right and act this way and act that way and make sure you graduate well. And then when you get married, you marry nice. And then make sure you have your kids and you raise them right. And then you're going to buy a house and you're going to do, right, that there's this whole script for how this whole thing is supposed to go on. But in order for the performance to go on, somebody somewhere is suffering, right? In order to feed the machine that creates the performance, some bodies have to go in there in order to feel that they're the coal that this machine runs on. I think of, you know, so much of the show, sometimes something like buy a house, right? This is part of the American dream. Mm-hmm. You're supposed to do this. Well, look at the crash. Look at that great, huge economic crash we had 2007, 2008. People were buying houses. People that couldn't afford houses were buying houses. And you think, well, we're pretty rational. Why would we do that? And it's because we're supposed to. That's part of the show.
Because it was like the milestone of saying, I'm striving too.
Yeah, I'm striving too.
My kids deserve a lawn.
Right. My kids deserve a lawn. And then when you get it, and then realizing that it wasn't your show. It was the show of the people that gave you the loan. It was the show of the banks. It was their show. And it falls apart, and you're just the coal that fueled it.
There's a question for you on Twitter.
Oh.
Wonder how Jose's parents felt on raising an American, in quotes. Curious if they intentionally did anything differently.
Yes, absolutely. It's actually, it's making me tear up a little bit. Ever since I was 9 or 10, my father would take me every summer to Honduras. And I'd had an understanding of what my origins were, and I'd had an understanding of, yeah, okay, yes, you didn't have pencils. I'm lucky to have all these pencils, right? And just this implicit message that I got growing up that I was somehow ungrateful, right, for all these great things. And yet I had this very comfortable suburban life, and looking around, so did everybody else I knew, right? And then I get there, and from very early on, year after year, I start to see what it is not to have. I start to see people that are starving. I start to see people whose ribs are sticking out. I start to see people who don't have clothes or don't have shoes. I remember very clearly, like, walking along on a path in rural Honduras. I was a little boy, and there was another little boy with me, and he was really about, like, oh, be careful, you know, you don't get your shoes wet in there or over there or over there. He was just like, he was very concerned with getting his shoes muddy and dirty. And it just didn't occur to me, like, why would I worry about that? I got another pair of shoes in my backpack because we were going to go stay at a farm out there. And it occurred to me, of course he takes care of his shoes. He only got one pair, right? And that was pretty heavy for a 9-year-old kid that had been grown up in privilege, right? In real privilege. And a lot of, and I hate the word privilege because we don't like to think of, nobody likes thinking of themselves as having privilege. And so maybe it's not the right word. I have a friend that prefers the word blindness, right? That I had a blindness to that because the world I knew didn't have that. So I think both my parents really wanted me to be able to see that. And the best way for me to see that is for them to show me where I come from.
I think they'd be moved and delighted that it's had the kind of impact on you that it has, that it's meaningful today.
It's very difficult to imagine for a lot of Americans what it is to have nothing and to live in a situation or a society that even when you have nothing, they will even take that from you. To live in a situation where you're not safe. You don't know when the government's going to come crashing through your door. You don't know when the rebels are going to show up and take your kids away and conscript them. You don't know, even after the war, when the gangs are going to show up and say, hey, you have to pay a war tax, right, for living in our neighborhood and having a business here. Most of us in America have no concept of what that's like. And so when we think of freedom, we think of, well, I want to be able to drive down the street without having to stop too many times at the stoplights, or I want to be able to pay less at the grocery store, or I want to pay less taxes, versus the freedom of I just want to be able to wake up, walk down the street without being terrified.
This is our conversation where we bring you into the discussion about what it means to be an American. The phone lines are open on this, the social media channels. I'm on Twitter at @CarrieNPR. Steph Curtis moderating a discussion at nprnews.org/live. And you can call in. I hope you will. 800-242-2828, 651-227-6000. More of your thoughts on this, your reflections. I will get right back to the phone calls here and the tweets on this on the other side of news. But to John Wanamaker now. Hi, John.
Hi, Carrie. The Federal Aviation Administration is restricting flights over an area of North Dakota where law enforcement is facing off with people protesting construction of the Dakota Access oil pipeline. A months-long dispute over the pipeline reached a crisis point over the weekend when some 200 protesters set up camp on land owned by pipeline developer Energy Transfer Partners. Yesterday, authorities gathered in the area with heavy equipment, including Humvees and buses, and demanded they leave. The protesters refused. Donald Trump says he won't commit to working with Hillary Clinton if she is elected president. He told ABC's Good Morning America that he will make the decision at a later date, saying, "Hopefully I won't have to make that decision." New York's Archbishop Cardinal Timothy Dolan has said that in a warm private exchange at an otherwise testy charity dinner last week, Clinton had told Trump that whatever happens, we need to work together afterward. However, Clinton sidestepped a question yesterday about whether she will meet one-on-one with Trump after the election. Iraqi commanders say their forces have pushed Islamic State militants out of a small town south of Mosul and are now 20 miles from the city's center. A general says Iraqi army forces retook the town yesterday. He says local tribal and militia forces have been deployed to protect the gains while his troops regroup for their next push toward the center of Iraq's second largest city. Commanders say militants south of Mosul have been withdrawing north toward the city, taking hundreds of civilians with them to use as human shields. Stocks are down on Wall Street despite some positive news on earnings from U.S. companies. Twitter had risen 2% after announcing layoffs. That's fallen back, however, a little bit. Oil prices stabilized today after falling for three straight days. The NASDAQ off 0.25%. The Dow and S&P down slightly. This is Minnesota Public Radio News.
All things considered is essential to you this election season, from fact-checking the candidates to putting their stump speeches in context. Politics and the issues that matter. I'm Tom Cran. Join me weekdays here on NPR News, starting at 3.
You hear us talking about what it means to be an American today. If you've missed any of the conversation or missed part of them, you can find them on my podcast, Roseanne Cash, Claudia Rankine, Louis Surreya, and more, reflecting on what it means to be an American in this election season and beyond. Look for it on the podcast. Search NPR News with Carrie Miller in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
Programming on Minnesota Public Radio is supported in part by Target, committed to giving 5% of its profit to communities, more than $4 million every week. More information at target.com/community.
That's what it means when we say America is exceptional. For we were born of change. We broke the old aristocracies, declaring ourselves entitled not by bloodline, but endowed by our Creator with certain inalienable rights. We secure our rights and responsibilities through a system of self-government, of and by and for the people. That's why we argue and fight with so much passion and conviction, because we know our efforts matter. We know America is what we make of it.
It's President Obama in Selma, Alabama, earlier this year. As we continue our discussion on what it means to be an American, Jose Santos with us, an anthropologist from Metro State. To the phones to David in St. Paul. Hey, good morning, David. Thanks for waiting.
Hey, good morning, Carrie. You know, to quote King, I have a dream that one day this nation will live out the full meaning of its creed. That's, you know, I guess I'll push back on the idea that there's some kind of bifurcation between whether or not we're talking about a dream or something that's hard and real.
Mm-hmm.
It is a dream that is hard and real. And you know, it's complicated. And it's complicated for lots of us. You know, I'm mostly African-American, but my grandmother was half Shinnecock Indian, which is from the northern shore of Long Island. And, you know, we have a responsibility, as has been said earlier in the program, to recognize that with our rights come the responsibility. And the principal responsibility is, you know, to love our neighbors and understand that this country, you know, people are invested in this country in so many different ways. And I would submit that patriotism is important, because I think that's the nature of the that's the manifestation of the investment. You know, it's one thing to want to just come here. It's another thing to want to be here for the long haul and be part of this just silly, crazy experiment that we call America. You know, the people who want to come here that desperately, you have to understand they are invested. They're already invested. They're pre-invested. The other part of it, of course, is part of my ancestry is of a peoples that came here stacked like cordwood on ships. All right? And when they got here, they were stuck here. And by and large, they turned around and said, all right, we're going to make the best of this. And when the really hard part of making this country, you know, came into being, 200,000 black men were recruited into the United States Army, and they fought for the freedom of their own people and the freedom of this country.
Jose, you had a question for David?
David, you said something that really stuck out for me, and I think you articulated something that's been kind of an undertone and things the other callers have said. And that's what you said, one of our obligations is to love one another. And I want to ask you, what do you think gets in the way?
I'm a pretty progressive person, politically, anybody who knows me well. But I'm going to say this. There are going to be people, there are people, and there will always be people in this country. And I'm going to say it, too. I'm going to say it nice and straight so you can understand it. There are white bigots in this country who will never, with a capital N, accept my Americanness.
Well, I don't think that's a revelation, Dave. I think we've seen some of that, and we know that. But that doesn't mean that the rest of us be committed to the values of what it is to be an American. That doesn't negate, I think, the rest of our commitment, does it?
Please, this is the hard and real part.
Yeah.
The hard and real part is this. Most of my friends are Caucasian. Most of my friends are white. Most of my friends do, in fact, most of my white friends, the overwhelming majority of the people who I know, do accept my Americanness. Okay? I'm not painting with a broad brush. I'm reaching out with that small, fine brush, okay? And the fact is that that is the case. There are people who will never accept my Americanness. They will never accept the Americanness of our Hispanic brothers. They will never even accept the Americanness of the first people, of the people who greeted the Mayflower.
So here's what I need to do, David. We have phone lines full of people that want to get in on this. I want to give Jose a chance to reflect on what you've said, and then I need to take some other calls.
Thank you for answering that, David. It made me think of something, actually, that came up the other day, and I was talking about the wall that Trump wants to build.
Mm-hmm.
And they were asking me, about, what is it? Because I was talking about the shows that you've been doing. And I said, I think about being an American. I think, they want a wall to keep a lot of people like me out. And the response was, but not all of us want that wall. And I remember the first thought that went through my head was actually a frightened, angry, defensive one, which was, just because there's people that don't want the wall doesn't make the ones that do want the wall disappear. I'm still have to be afraid of them. I still need to be worried about them. And that there's this inner conflict about that, just being very aware of that there are people that disagree on a level that's so, so basic that you're afraid that they're out to get you.
But here's the thing, and you're bringing up again something David said about white bigots.
Yeah.
I don't want that part of what it means to be an American to swamp because they are the loudest voices that cable news is interested in. I don't want that to swamp and define everybody else's commitment to the American value. I'm not saying it doesn't exist, Jose.
Right.
But
No. I agree.
Squeaky wheels and they're loud, but they're not. I don't think they're great in number.
Right? Do we call them Are they as? There's a great Russian saying, from far away it looks like a dragon, up close it's a lizard.
Exactly.
Right? And I think what I was trying to say is not that I believe that they are going to come get me or that they can touch me or anything like that, but that there's this inherent fear, I think, in the experience of it, of just hearing somebody say it, even if they're the only one that says it in the room.
Mm-hmm.
Even if somebody says something in a room and somebody else immediately, not even you, slams them down, there's the fear of having heard it. Right. There's the fear. Is there a dragon out there lurking for me?
See, this is probably the difference between I don't feel like and here's the difference between our life experience. I don't feel like I have anything to fear from those people. But then I wouldn't. Right.
There's the difference. Right. There's
exactly,
the difference.
Right.
I can't escape it. Right.
I thought this might be an opportune place to play part of a conversation with Claudia Rankin on what it means to be African-American. And I think she echoes some of what David brought up. Let's listen.
I think that for white Americans, there is the ability to move around this country with freedom, with a sense that you own the space. For African-Americans, I have a passport. I am a citizen. And yet you know that you could be killed for just walking in the street or playing with a toy gun, or you're at the mercy at someone else's imagination or constructed fears, and that you or your brother or your, sister could be pulled over and before you know it, dead. And I could be wrong, but I don't think white Americans move through the landscape with that same tenuous precarity.
And I think she's right.
Right. The inherent fear. And then how that turns into actual structure, into actual social structure when you start talking about there's places I won't go, or there's things that I can't do because of this fear. Right, it does become a limiting factor, and she puts that so well. And it's that in some ways, because of these fears, we're policed, right? Policed in the sense of we're regulated. What we can do and not do is regulated by these fears. And then something else that she said, I think, also in the interview was part of the problem is why aren't they policing what they think?
Right?
Why aren't they policing their own prejudice? Why aren't they policing? Right.
She has that line in Citizen, or that phrase in Citizen, where she talks about how Black America is afraid because the white man's imagination can't be controlled. I'm not saying it right, but I mean that speaks right to what you're suggesting.
Whether it's a fear for your life or the anxiety of things aren't quite all right. It's say I had you know, this scenario I painted with you, that my ex-girlfriend's father, mm-hmm. you know, what if we'd gotten married? Do I need to be afraid every time at Thanksgiving? Do I need to be afraid of every December that they're going to say we had a child, that's going to plant the idea in my child's head, you are less than, you don't come from quite the right stock, right? Do I need to be afraid of that? That children are going to be affected by that.
See, it's so funny because when you told that story, my reaction was, well, that's kind of sad that he's so misinformed. You know, I kind of had the confidence of the high road.
Yeah. Yeah. I think partly, you know, it's misinformation, but partly it's people thinking out loud, right?
Yes.
People thinking out loud and finally expressing themselves out loud. You know, a lot of people, I think when Trump started saying a lot of stuff that he says, we're genuinely surprised. But for some of us, I myself, there was no surprise there. This is stuff we've been talking about for years and years and years. We've been saying, no, there's a lot of this out there. This is a general sentiment. You know, there's people that would rather I wasn't a citizen. They're like, oh, no, no. And then somebody actually says this stuff and they're like, oh, you're like, no, I've been telling you this the whole time. I think that right. The only difference is, I mean, one of the big things that people say about Trump is that support him is like, he says what I'm thinking, right? He says the things that we've all been thinking. So it's like, yeah, this stuff's been there for a long
time. Not we've all been thinking.
That they've all been thinking.
Step off the page.
Richard says, what it means to be an American is very different to people whose experience is urban rather than rural. If you live in the Twin Cities, your experience of being an American might be much more like that of a Chicagoan or a New Yorker than someone from Windham, Bemidji, or Cook County. For instance, I suspect that volunteers for military service are disproportionately rural or suburban.
To the phones, to Muhammad in Minneapolis. Hey, good morning, Muhammad. Thanks for waiting.
Yeah, no problem. Good morning.
Good morning. What do you want to say? How have you been thinking about this?
I've been thinking that most people forget the basic components of being an American. Like, if you're an American citizen, you're an American. Yes or no, you know? It's that. But there are other components, like inherently believing in American values, freedom, responsibility, these inalienable rights that most people around the world don't have, and they're constantly being transgressed against.
Mm-hmm.
And, many people, I mean, me growing up, I was, I'm a Somali American, and many people didn't think I was American. Even in school, at some point when I was in elementary school, someone asked to see my birth certificate. And it really hurt that I don't understand. I was born here. I watch the same shows you do. I go to the same places you do. I speak the same language you do. It just doesn't make sense. Like, and I started seeing that people were afraid of what they didn't understand.
Mm-hmm.
There's a quote that Truman said, America wasn't built on fear. It was built on courage. So even though you see someone else who thinks differently than you, who looks differently than you, you can't fear them. Otherwise, that leads to bias. And it leads to you believing that they can't be part of you. You can't relate to them. And you can never be in the same group as them, which we all are under the same umbrella, American, being an American.
Jose. Muhammad, if I might, again, I want to try to get in some other calls. I really appreciate it. And Jose,
yeah.
a quick thought.
You know, when Muhammad was speaking, I thought of growing up myself. And I thought of how very often, right? So my mother's Guatemalan, my father's Honduran. But most often people would ask me things like, so what part of Mexico are you from? When did you get here? Not as in when did my family get, but when did you get here from Mexico, right?
Uh-huh.
And I was born in Dallas, Texas, right? Like what's more American than Texas? and that would be something that I would get constantly as a child, and then became, I guess you become hyper aware of it when you're little.
Is it genuine? What is it?
I think there's a range. I think some people think they're being polite when they say things like that. I remember when I moved here.
And are they not being polite?
For them, they're being polite. I think, again, one person's dream is another one's nightmare. Uh-huh. So they think they're being polite, and sometimes they'll say things that are really offensive. When I moved here 6 years ago, to to start the position that I have now at Metro State. Within about 2 weeks, I had, you know, everybody popping in to say hello, oh, this, that, and the other. And I just remember it strange. I was told on two or three separate occasions where I could get the best burritos, where I could get the best burritos in town, right? And that when people were like, oh, we should go to lunch sometime. And they're like, oh, there's
let's go get burritos.
Yeah, and let's go get taco. There's a great taco place. And it's like, it's funny because, you know, Guatemalans, you know, don't do tacos all that much. Guatemalans, Hondurans are more into pupusas. But, and then sort of like, wow, this is your version of polite, is to say this kind of bigoted stuff to me. And then the challenge, of course, is they would never see themselves as bigoted. They see themselves as polite. That was the nice thing they had. It's just that inside their brains, right, and this is just the way human brains work, they've got this category that they see visually on me,
mm-hmm.
and it's got this list of stuff underneath it,
yeah.
right? And Mexico and tacos and burritos is on there, and they're like, right. oh, well, let me be polite.
Comes
so let
with
me
a lot of
up,
assumptions.
Yeah, let me offer up these assumptions that I have, because I know that'll make them happy, right? That's one of those experiences we have. The worst is when it's, you know, what's on that list, other than burritos and tacos, is fear.
Yeah.
I need to fear this person. I think that's what Muhammad was talking about, that to be seen. And then, you know, again, the brain does this almost automatically. It's learned, but it does it very, very quickly. And that's, you see the category, and in that list is fear. Be wary. These guys are criminals, this, that, or the other, or I don't know what this means. And yeah, you get that defensiveness, and that's unfortunate at best.
I want to play a reflection here from Luis Urrea on The Dream. And I think he's pretty hopeful that new next generations are going to address some of the things we've been talking about.
So many of those young people are just looking for that embrace that makes them love the community they're in and feel loved and seen by that community, which is then waiting to grow into that love and embrace for the entire nation. The slightest inclusion, the slightest taste of the American dream, which I believe, in spite of propaganda, is still active and powerful, transforms people.
Can we end on that hopeful
yeah.
note?
How nice
there?
Is that? The slightest taste.
I know.
The slightest taste of it.
And the hunger
yeah,
for
the,
that.
The hunger for it.
Despite a lot of the, what, fear, the messages, the noise, as you put it
yeah,
earlier.
Is it background noise?
That's right.
Or is it the substance of this place?
Right.
I never longed for the United States more than when I was doing field work in El Salvador, a very dangerous place. And what I longed for was that feeling of being able to walk around unafraid and to be able to go get sesame chicken. And that was home to me. That was America to me.
Not burritos.
Wait. Yeah, no, not burritos, sesame chicken.
Jose, thank you.
Thank you.
I love having you in the studio. I'm so glad you were game to come in and do
Absolutely,
this with us.
Anytime. Thank you so much.
You can hear all of the conversations of what it means to be an American. You can find them on my page, NPR News with Carrie Miller, or check them out on the podcast and listen at your leisure.